Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. In a 48-hour period this past October 2014, the number of states that allow same-sex marriage nearly doubled. As of this writing, 35 states allow same-sex couples to marry legally. Courts made that decision in 24 states, legislatures made the call in another 8, and in 3 states, including Washington, the decision went to voters. Mark Solomon has an extensive background in advocacy and public policy, but he wasn't necessarily a natural pick to help lead the campaign to make same-sex marriage a reality. In Winning Marriage, he tells the story of how a seemingly impossible goal to win the freedom to marry for all Americans came near reality in such a short period of time. Mark Solomon spoke about the fight for marriage equality at Town Hall Seattle on December 1st, 2014. This talk was presented by Town Hall and University Bookstore as part of the Civic Series. Series sponsors include Boeing, the Real Networks Foundation, and the True Brown Foundation. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for this recording.
Mark Solomon is the National Campaign Director for Freedom to Marry, a nonprofit that works for the rights of same-sex couples to marry in the United States. Locally, he led the Washington United for Marriage Coalition, chairing the campaign that advocated for a yes vote in 2012's historic R-74 referendum to legalize same-sex marriage here in Washington State. Nationally, he has played leading roles in similar campaigns in New York, Illinois, California, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Maine, and elsewhere, and he has become a leading spokesperson on national television, radio, and print media. For his work, he has received multiple awards, including the prestigious Franklin Delano Roosevelt Award from the Massachusetts Democratic Party and the Jerry E. Studs Visibility Awards for service and leadership to the LGBT community. He will be joined on stage by Lacey All. Ms. All was the chair of R-74 the campaign for marriage equality in Washington State, leading the coalition Washington United for Marriage. She is also the public policy chair for the Human Rights Campaign and newly elected co-chair on the National Board of Directors for the Human Rights Campaign. And in her spare time, she is a strategy director at Starbucks. So she is a busy lady in this movement. Tonight they will be discussing Mr. Solomon's new book, Winning Marriage, which tells the story of the successes of the campaign for the right for all to marry and the political, religious, and social roadblocks it has met along the way, and take a look at what it will take to make the freedom to marry a national right instead of just a right in most states. So please join me in offering a warm welcome for Mark Solomon and Lacey All.
Welcome tonight, everybody. So we're just going to have a little conversation about Mark's book that's come out, and hopefully you've all had a chance either to pick up a copy or before you leave tonight have a chance to stop by. He's going to do a signing for us. So I thought what we could start with a little bit is, you know, Mark, you've been in this movement for 13 years or longer.
That's 13 years, yeah.
Yep. And so I'm sort of curious, and I had a chance to read the book, and I was curious if you can talk a little bit about sort of what prompted this book in this moment and what you're hoping the reader's going to get from the book.
Sure. So and first, thanks to all of you for showing up and coming out on this first day back, and I understand it's chilly for Seattle. Yeah, I wrote the book. Initially, I wrote it after we won in Massachusetts, which was the first state to win marriage nationwide, in the country. And I ran that campaign. And after we won and held Massachusetts, I thought it was an important story to tell. And then things just started happening. We, you know, then won New York, and we had the amazing victory that you led here in Washington with so many people who were involved in that campaign, and the president's evolution, and and now some of these amazing victories in the courts of late. So I've been writing this book for 5+ years and in my spare time, it just seemed like seemed like now was a good time to put it out there. And what I really hope to accomplish with it is a couple things. Number one, and you all know this as well as anybody, that the work of civil rights is hard, really hard work. And it's, what I try to do in the book is to show what it takes of people stepping out of their comfort zones and having the difficult conversations with their lawmakers and family members and friends and knocking on doors and in challenging parts of the states and, and then sticking, and some of the leaders sticking with it year after year after year when it seemed like it was so difficult. So I wanted to show what it's really taken, and hopefully we can learn some lessons from it that apply to other important movements.
Right. Well, one of the things that I, in reading the book a little bit about, there was a couple things that struck me, but you'll see this as you have a chance to go through it yourself, but really it takes, gives you a seat at the table at some of the strategy decisions along the way and what it takes to win some of these campaigns. And what I thought we could do is maybe start and talk a little bit about Massachusetts. We won't spend a lot of time there, but I think you were such a cornerstone of that campaign, and I'd love for everyone really to be able to hear about your work there. The book opens with a couple of things that I thought were worth talking a little bit about. And the first, of course, is opens with Mary Bonito, who was, of course, the lawyer in the case, and the first civil rights lawyer with GLAAD, or the Gay and Lesbian Advocacy Defenders. And, in fact, the book is dedicated in part to her. And so I thought you could talk to a little bit about the role that she's played in Massachusetts and sort of the impetus of how the work began there.
Sure. So, Mary Bonito is one of my true heroes, and she is a Barney Frank calls her the Thurgood Marshall of our movements, of the marriage movement. She's someone who's brought lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit, sort of tying them very carefully to have the maximum impact. She's the civil rights director for Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders based in Boston, and they work exclusively on New England. She brought the first, the first marriage case was in, sort of modern day marriage case was in the 90s that Evan Wolfson and team litigated in Hawaii. But then after that, after that victory, and then, which was taken away by a constitutional amendment, Mary brought a lawsuit in Vermont in 2000, and we won. But the Vermont Supreme Court said, "Look, you can either do marriage or do something equivalent, so-called equivalent to marriage, provide the rights and protections of marriage." And there was a huge blowback, and they moved immediately to civil unions. And even with civil unions, there was still a huge backlash in the states, and a lot of lawmakers lost their seats. After that, though, Mary once again brought a lawsuit on behalf of seven couples in Massachusetts who went to their town clerk's office in 2001, and they were all denied marriage licenses. And on behalf of those seven couples, she brought the suit in Massachusetts. And we, for the first time ever, won an all-out marriage ruling. I remember the day like it was yesterday. It was really, hugely amazing, emotional, exciting day.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you all know this, but Mark, it was a 3.5-year battle.
Yeah. So after we won November 18th, 2003, and we had our 4-3 ruling, and immediately, I remember I was on New England cable news live as the ruling happened, and then different elected officials were and sort of national figures were providing their comments, and I remember the attacks were so harsh and severe from some of the most powerful forces in the world, like the Vatican, for example, George W. Bush had a statement immediately, and Karl Rove went on to use this issue in the campaigns in 2004, and our governor then that we've shared with the rest of America, Mitt Romney, provided some really, was just had some really harsh statements. But the thing is, it wasn't just the sort of the usual suspects that you expect to come after us. You know, many of the mainstream Democrats in Massachusetts were not with us then, including John Kerry, who opposed the decision and supported a constitutional amendment to take it away. So we were really on our own. And I remember at that moment, you know, the only person over the course of this 2 hours I was on TV, the only national figure who was fully positive was Barney Frank. And I was like, we really had to do some fighting to hold on to what we just won.
You know, what I want to encourage everybody to do is there's about four chapters that go through Massachusetts. Oh, thank you. There's about four chapters that go through Massachusetts, and it really outlines the very specific strategies over the course of that 3.5 years that is really the back and forth that it took to finally fully achieve and maintain marriage equality in the state of Massachusetts in 2003. So a lot of inside the ball game. Maybe we can talk a little bit about New York.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, after you get through the first section of the book, we sort of are, which is mostly lead you through a chronological order of what's happened over the course of the last, let's call it 12 years in the marriage fight. We get a little peek into New York and what was happening there, and what, coming off a devastating loss, sort of a catalyst, you needed a catalyst in New York to be able to both create a coalition and to win marriage. And you found a hero in the newly elected governor there in New York. So talk a little about his role and what he did to provide the spark needed.
Sure. So in New York, we lost in 2009. It was a really devastating loss. We had a legislative vote, and we lost by more than 10 votes. And what had happened right before that vote in 2009 was that the LGBT community and some of our major donors had invested more than $1 million in the Democrats in the state Senate to flip the Senate to Democratic control. And they were, you know, that happened. And the Democratic leaders had promised that if they were in control, they would move a marriage bill and pass it. And they untruthed, and they didn't. So what happened was, after this terrible vote, our community really was furious, and they went on and took out put together a pack and took out a few lawmakers, both Democrats and Republicans, who said, who voted against us. But then it was this moment where, we had this newly elected governor, Andrew Cuomo, and he was an unlikely sort of hero. People didn't know what to expect, and he embraced this cause with a fervency and a passion, and not just a passion. Like I worked, and the guy who wrote the foreword to the book was Deval Patrick in Massachusetts, who's a great guy and a moral leader. Cuomo had a very different skill set that he brought to the table. He was a brilliantly shrewd politician, sort of Machiavellian, knows how to get things done, knows how to persuade, knows how to pressure, knows how to push. And, I ended up for the last 2 weeks of the campaign, I was in Albany the whole time working with him and some of the other leaders in the marriage campaign from HRC and the local organizations, and just sort of watching. We met with Cuomo every day to every other day, and just sort of watching him in action and supporting him was unbelievable. Twisting arms and patting people on the back sort of walking them through their anxieties, and sort of driving the cause forward. There was one moment I remember when I was sitting with him, and he brought in his two daughters, he sort of jokingly said, "Do you mind if my two closest advisors come and join me for this meeting?" And out came his two daughters, and it was really pretty adorable, and it was clear he wanted them to see what was happening and wanted them to capture the civil rights history that was being made. And I was thinking and looking at these girls, and they you know, Andrew Cuomo's ex-wife was Bobby Kennedy's daughter. So I was just thinking, like, these girls have as grandparents Mario Cuomo and Bobby Kennedy. And I was like, you know, and here they're sitting with their father watching him, you know, watching how the sausage is made, but the, you know, the sausage of civil rights. That's a terrible metaphor. But anyhow, the sausage of civil rights. But so it was really a moving time. And, you know, there's no question we wouldn't have won in Albany during, which is a really one of the most sort of, they call it a transactional state capital. It's a really sort of grim place to do business. And we wouldn't have won without his determination.
There's one point in the book where he quotes, or you quote him saying that, which I think was very poignant, to not vote with with fear, but rather with your conscience. And so it seemed as if you really captured the spirit of what, how he was able to one by one pull the votes needed.
Yeah, for sure. It was, and he worked on Republicans, and he, you know, it was, and just, yeah, it was. I mean, he had some tough conversations too. What turned out, and you know, you can read about this in the book, which is something that I was really appalled by, was that there were the Democratic leaders in the Senate in New York liked the you know, getting campaign dollars from the gay community, and so they were, you know, at a few occasions in the last 24 hours of the marriage fight in New York, the Democratic leaders were trying to secretly put the kibosh on the bill and blame it on the Republicans, so that they could then say, "Hey, you need to fund the Democrats in order to have a chance at this." And Cuomo stepped in and just quietly said, and these were like the most petty tactics you can imagine, like having, you know, lining up lots of people to speak to try to sort of dare the Republicans to pull the bill, and just the most petty things, saying that one guy wouldn't be able to be in the be there for the votes because he had to be in court because he'd been indicted, and in fact, you know, Cuomo's chief of staff called and found out this guy didn't have to be in court. It was just, you know, the most petty stuff. And thankfully, Cuomo was strong enough to call these folks out and keep them, you know, hold them accountable.
I think what Washington State learned from that lesson in New York is, you know, we certainly were lucky enough to have a governor in our state that was such a strong advocate. And I think that, among many other things, we learned from New York. So maybe we can talk about the four states and what happened just a year later after the victory, the ultimate victory in New York, that led to the four-state ballot campaign, where for the first time the ballot box was going to determine the lives and fates of so many LGBT families. So talk to us about the landscape, and I can share a little bit of color of what was happening here and how Freedom to Marry came to be such a strong advocate and ally in the marriage fight here in Washington State.
Sure. So the context was that we'd never, you know, we were 0 for 33 at the ballots. And from a national perspective, we were, you know, we wanted to win. But we wanted to win, you know, we wanted to win one. We wanted to maybe win two. The idea of winning four just seemed, you know, in retrospect, it seems easy. But, you know, looking at it from back then, it was like that was pretty daunting to try to take on four ballot fights and win four ballot fights when we'd never won one. And the, you know, the environment was, or the context was, that we'd lost, you know, the most devastating battle in our fight. From my vantage point, we lost a Proposition 8 fight in California in 2008. And our side ended up spending $45 million. We lost 52-48. And then we, you know, a year later, we lost again. We lost in Maine by about the same margin. So a lot of the major donors in the, you know, were not interested in investing in ballot fights. They were like, you know, let's try the courts. Let's try to pick off the states where we can win in the legislature. But a state like Washington or Maryland, where, you know, you can, and Maine too, where you can win in the legislature, but if you do, it's, you know, very likely to end up on the ballot. There was a lot of reticence about taking those on, and that was the sort of the context. And our frame was, you know, we want to take away our opponent's main talking point, which was that our side, you know, when the people get to decide, our side will never win. And so we wanted to win at least one and hopefully two or three.
You know, one of the things that we learned from New York, in addition to the power of a strong governor, is the importance of a strong field campaign. And so I thought maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, what we learned both in New York and then what we brought forward in the campaigns in Maine and Maryland and Washington State about what it takes to not just win, but keep the win, and what other movements can learn from that.
So I think on the that in our sort of the backbone of our marriage campaigns, whether in the legislature or at the ballot, you know, is in the grassroots. These issues are not going to be won, you know, with lobbyists in a state capitol, because they are, you know, they're deep emotional issues. And our opponents are going to do whatever they can to frighten voters, frighten lawmakers, persuade lawmakers that they will lose their seats if they vote our way. And we need to show, both with quantity in key districts, in the districts where we needed votes, as well as in the, you know, the quality of conversation. We needed to get people to, you know, in legislative fights, sit down with their lawmaker, get same-sex couples, their family members, people who have a connection to the lawmaker from their district, to make the personal case. And then in a referendum, and, you know, you here in Washington had both a legislative campaign and a referendum. You know, it's not just the, you know, X number of lawmakers you need to persuade. It's the, you know, the millions of voters who are going to turn out. So having those conversations at people's doors, and really having genuine discussion about marriage, and about why they have the perspective that they have. And, you know, I really think that what we've done over the course of the past decade plus is we've taken Americans on a journey, and we've shown them that for us, marriage is, you know, for same-sex couples, marriage is crucial. And it's something that we take very seriously. And that was, you know, and that's something that can be conveyed, you know, it's hard to convey it, but it can be conveyed in personal conversations and at the, you know, in a sit down meeting, in a long conversation at someone's door. It's not the kind of thing where you can just sort of, you know, rattle off a few talking points. And it takes real engagement to show, you know, to explain why gay couples want to marry, and to get people to a place where they, in order to be their best selves, they want to vote our way. So that's not work that can be done, you know, in a state capitol with lobbyists, or can be done in an inauthentic way. It has to be very authentic, and that takes boots on the ground and volunteers all over the place.
You know, I think, Mark, as you were talking about that, it made me think a little bit about Prop 8 and what we learned there, and how all these have sort of led to, you know, what we're experiencing now. But what Prop 8 taught us was really how to be prepared for the message. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about sort of the video that we all know about that happened in California that was pretty damning to the movement, where we really couldn't respond. That it was a ad that ran, I think it was called "It's Already Happening." And but it instilled fear, and it, I think, as a movement, made us realize we needed to talk in a really, you know, talk about humanity and how we were more alike than we're different. So talk about the work that Freedom to Marry did around messaging and sort of responding to that, and how that helped us in all four states.
Sure. So in California, you know, our message, our affirmative message, you know, we found wasn't really connecting with voters. And what we went back to the drawing boards, and we looked at the messaging that we'd been using and how we were talking about marriage. And what we found was that there was this one, you know, there's this one poll that was this real aha moment. It was done in Oregon, and it was people who were asked, you know, voters who were asked why marriage or why they wanted to get married, or why marriage was important to them. And the number one answer was love and commitment. And the number two answer was, like, benefits. But it was like 70% said said, out of a sense of love and commitment, that's why marriage is important to us. Then they were asked, why do they think gay people want to marry? And the number one answer was, I don't know. And the number two answer was for benefits. And we really, there was like a 50% gap in between why people thought that they wanted to get married and why they thought same-sex couples wanted to marry. We knew that we needed to transform that because people hold up marriage as a very important thing, and it is a very important thing. And even if their own marriage isn't working out so well, it's still the idea of marriage and the ultimate relationship. People needed to understand and believe that same-sex couples were taking it very seriously. So what we did is we just made the honest case, and it really is the honest case, that gay couples want to marry for the same reasons that everyone else, out of a deep abiding sense of love and commitment and interest in taking care of our families. And we oftentimes used parents to make that case. Parents of, who have both straight kids and gay kids, and who would talk about, my daughter was able to marry her husband, and shouldn't my son have the same ability to marry his partner? But also, the other thing we had to do was take Americans on a journey. It was very important not to call out people as bad people who weren't with us. I mean, we all grew up in a society where marriage was a guy and a woman, and we all grew up, or most of us grew up, in religions that taught us that's what marriage was. So the idea that people were conflicted on this issue was we had to be able to embrace that and understand it, and then take them on a journey and explain to them who gay people are, who same-sex couples are, and why we want to marry, and get them to a place where they then can say, because I want to treat other people the way I want them to treat me, that's where I need to be. Humanized. It's humanized definitely humanize the issue and help people see that same-sex couples are are just like anybody else.
Only more fabulous.
Exactly.
No. So I want to talk a little bit about this notion of a journey and actually talk about the role of the president. As early as 2003 with President Bush and the comments he made after the ruling in Massachusetts, all the way to President Obama's evolution. But before I do that, I couldn't let the moment pass without saying, here in Washington State, we certainly benefited from those lessons learned. And I see a couple of couples in the room who actually shared their stories with us and helped us win marriage here in Washington State, and certainly the work of Jennifer Cast and the work she did to lead the fundraising efforts for marriage equality to make sure we can stay in the living rooms and be very present and tell our stories over and over again until we ultimately won in 2012. So let's talk a little bit about the president. I wanted to read an excerpt from the book where it's a quote from President Bush that he said right after 2002. He said, "Marriage is a sacred institution between a man and a woman. Today's decision on the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court violates this important principle. I will work with all congressional leaders and others to do what is legally necessary to defend the sanctity of marriage." And then, of course, in 2000, not shortly thereafter, he suggested a federal ban. And it wasn't that far in the mix that, even President Obama was on his own evolution. So, which ultimately in 2011, maybe, when did he come?
2012.
2012, yep. Where he ultimately came out to say he supported. So talk to us a little bit about the importance of his role in this and the journey that he was on and how it sort of how it parlays into what you're talking about helping Americans be okay with being on a journey.
Sure. So having the president on our side was something that we knew was really important. And it was really important both for, very specific reasons related to having the federal government on our side with respect to benefits and protections. But even more, at a more fundamental level, the presidency is in so many ways the official voice of the country, and having the president embrace the freedom to marry just was you know, we knew would help other Americans on their journey, and it would, you know, it would be a huge momentum boost to the cause. In 2008, when President or when Obama, Senator then Senator Obama and Hillary Clinton were running, neither of them were, you know, embraced marriage. They both said they supported civil unions. And, you know, I think, you know, people ask, well, do you really think that that's what they thought? And I think that what I really think is that there is a pretty narrow band that candidates feel like they can, you know, positions that candidates feel like they can take in order to be thought of as viable. And what we needed to do was to move, you know, push things along to a place where, you know, supporting marriage for gay couples was a viable political position for a Democratic candidate to take, that they would feel that. And we needed to push hard the president to take that position. And so, you know, we went about that in a bunch of ways, but the way that I thought, you know, that we took on that was that I thought made the most impact was we came up with the idea of putting a plank in the Democratic Party platform, a Freedom to Marry plank, and we launched it, and we were able to get the support of a whole wide range of electeds. 22 U.S. senators, Nancy Pelosi came out for it, and that really put pressure on the president to, you know, like, yikes, if all of these Democrats are for it, and it's going to be a big issue at the convention, you know, it would be a very difficult deal for him to be at the Democratic convention and not to, you know, and to be in a fight with his own party. What I found out since then is that the president took a journey on marriage. Obviously, he said he was evolving on the issue, and that he decided that he needed to be out on the cause before the 2012 election. And it wasn't Joe Biden, even though Joe Biden, you know, was honest on TV and talked about his support. But the president had made up his mind that he was going to talk about this before the election. He knew he couldn't get away with not talking about it during the election. He'd be asked about it over and over, and to say he was still evolving wasn't viable. So, you know, it was a real push. And then once he came out in support, you know, I know it was one of the proudest things he's done, and it's made a huge difference. In particular, it made a huge difference with African American voters who saw, you know, who heard the president and heard the language that he used in describing his evolution and the conversations with his kids, and, you know, he talked about his faith, and we just saw the numbers really skyrocket in support among African Americans after the president came out in support. And it was also so moving and emotional to hear him embrace the cause. That was one of the neatest moments in this fight.
Absolutely. And I think no one can forget both the convention and then, of course, his inaugural speech, where I think it was a proud moment for America. So I want to ask one more question. This just sort of sets the tone for sort of what's next. And I want you to all think about what questions you have. I think we have a couple of mics, and so we'll take a few questions here and get you participating in this conversation. But there's a moment in the book that talks about the coalition, many of the same members of the coalition that were present for New York and certainly for many of the states that did the ballot campaigns, all signed called the 2020 Vision. And basically, it set the course of what was the roadmap for the future. And so the idea was that by 2020, 10 states would have marriage equality, 10 would have civil union, 10 more would have civil unions, and then another 10 would have some protections. So today we're sitting here and 35 states have marriage equality. Over 65% of Americans live in a state where you can get a marriage license. A vast majority of Americans support full marriage equality. So we beat that goal. So tell us, from your perspective, what's next for us?
Well, we've got to finish the job. So, you know, too many people say it's now inevitable, it's done, it's over. And, you know, one of the things that I've always been struck by is that I remember when I first got involved in this as a volunteer 13 years ago, and when I went to work full-time on it, so many people were saying it's impossible. And there's something that impossible and inevitable have in common, and that is that neither of them require work. If you feel like something's impossible, you can, you know, why bother? If you feel like it's inevitable, why bother? So, I would say that it's not inevitable. I think, you know, we are going to win nationwide, and it will be in the next, you know, in a short, you know, relatively short period of time. But whether it's 8 years or 5 years or 2 years or 1 year matters. It matters to the, you know, 35% of Americans who live in a state where they can't marry. The Supreme Court is very closely divided, and I'm sure all of, you know, many of you who saw when Justice Ginsburg went to the hospital over Thanksgiving, you know, none of this stuff is a slam dunk. So happily she's back at work today. So that's great news. But what we need to do is we need to push hard to finish the job. And the way we're going to finish it, and this has always been the plan, is to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and ask the court to finish the job based on, you know, the equal protection guarantees in the Constitution. And initially the court, you know, didn't, you know, decided not to take up a case this year. Now, you know, we have a split in the circuits, and there are now cases out of four states that are back before the Supreme Court. I think there's a really, you know, there's a strong chance that they will take one of those up. And the work over the next 6 months to a year is to highlight the fact that America is ready. And so we're working hard to make the case in the South and in the places where, you know, where gay couples aren't marrying yet, to show that, you know, quote unquote, even you know, even your home state of Louisiana and Texas and Mississippi and Alabama, even those states are ready for marriage for gay couples. And I say even because, you know, the justices say they don't want to go too fast. We've always known that, you know, the sort of the way they've acted traditionally has been not to get out of sync with where the country is. And we imagine that if they see that the South and the Mountain West and, you know, more conservative parts of the country are okay with it. Even if they, you know, not everybody needs to be on board, but the country needs to be okay with it, then we think we can get the ruling that we want and that the Constitution demands. So we're going to keep the pedal to the metal until it's done. And once it's done, then it really will have been inevitable. So.
For that, Mark. So let's take a couple of questions. So I'm going to ask my friends here to help me figure out where the mics are. Oh, there, here they are. Just right here, and then I think we have one on this side. So I can see you now, so I might call on people. So who has a question? Oh, good. I'll come to you right next.
Yes, thanks. Just a brief question. What arguments have you found most successful when you're arguing with the religious right and the most conservative religious groups? Which arguments actually have you found that work?
So the good news is that we haven't had to change the minds of the most, you know, the most extreme religious folks. What we found works with people who are in the middle, which is where we've had to do our work, is, you know, a lot of people, you know, when it comes down to it, a lot of people are wrestling with their faith, or and they, if we can get people to a place where they see that their faith might teach one thing on homosexuality, but that, you know, when we ask them what's really important to them about their faith, they often will get to a place where they say, you know, it's about the golden rule. It's about how I treat my neighbors. I want, you know, how we treat one another. And if they can recognize that there's a conflict in what they're, you know, in sort of the doctrine of their of of some of their faiths. Now, you know, faiths are evolving as well. But in the doctrine of let's say, the Catholic Church versus what is important to them as spiritual religious people, that's when, and we've been able to do that in so many instances. That's what's been effective. So that people feel like in order to be the person that I'm called on to be by my faith, I need to embrace my brothers and sisters and their ability to get married.
You know, Mark, maybe you could talk a little bit about one of the things that was powerful here in Washington State. I know it was true for most other states, is we had an incredible religious coalition. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the power of leveraging storytellers in the community to carry a message.
Yeah, so I mean, organizing in the faith community is crucial, and having clergy sort of bear witness to the integrity of same-sex couples' relationships is also really important. And they've been some of our most powerful messengers across the board. And we've used people of faith in ads in most of the states where we've done work. And I can't tell you how powerful it's been for to have key clergy speak up when a Catholic bishop is saying one thing, and to have the Episcopal bishop countering is much more successful than having me or you do it. So that's been very, very important and powerful.
Thank you. Are you able to get to a mic, or can we get a mic here? Is this possible? Are you able to? Yeah, great.
Mark, it seems I don't have every step of the journey, but it was courts in Hawaii, and then courts in Massachusetts, and I think in Connecticut, etc. Then it became grassroots, really grassroots in a lot of states, Washington, Maine, Maryland. I mean, it wasn't the courts that did it. It was the people that did it. Mm-hmm. In your last remarks, you were talking about we've got to show the nine justices that the country is ready for it. However, I have friends in some of these states, and including Washington. Once they got marriage, it seems like the interest just dropped. It's like, okay, we got it in Washington. You live in Idaho. You do the work. I don't care anymore. And I wonder how do you think that's going to affect the Supreme Court or anybody else that's involved with this when the grassroots largely is dried up?
So it's a great question. I think what we're finding, though, is that even if the grassroots is less involved, and it's sort of human nature that once you've won in your state and you're able to marry, your interest doesn't sort of move across to your brothers and sisters in Boise and elsewhere. But what we're finding, though, is that the grassroots energy in some of these states where we need to make the case is really powerful. I've been able to spend some time in, I mean, now these are states that we've won, but I spent some time in Oklahoma, and we just launched Texas for Marriage, and the power of people who want to organize and make the case in those states is excellent. It's really terrific, as you said, we've won in the courtroom in a number of states. We've won in the legislatures. We've won at the ballot box. In order to win nationwide, the best way to win nationwide is to win, get a U.S. Supreme Court ruling to finish the job. So we don't, in these southern states, need to win within within the borders of the state. We need to have enough support and demonstrate that, Texas is ready for marriage equality. Louisiana and Mississippi, they're ready. So that's a different kind of organizing than trying to get enough votes in the legislature in some of those states and trying to overturn all these anti-gay ballot measures. But the grassroots energy is is strong, even if it's sort of, you know, it's not as strong in Massachusetts, and it's, I'm sure it's not, you know, it's not as strong here, but it's great to see in some places that are, where it's been really tough to be openly LGBT, and people are really embracing the opportunity that, hey, even in my state, this can actually happen.
I'll come to you next.
So much of the shift seems to be generational as well, and I think especially highlighted here in Washington by the involvement of the creative community and Macklemore and the music industry. Is there, do you feel like on the national scale there is a shift that is going to influence the eventual Supreme Court decision that is actually generational in this kind of movement overall?
Yeah, well, there's no question that you know, that young people are just overwhelmingly supportive. I mean, the latest polls have shown that 80% of millennial voters, including, you know, a strong majority of millennial Republicans, a majority of millennial evangelicals are with us. And so, you know, that, you know, so if you sort of do the math, eventually we're going to, you know, we're going to be in good shape. But the thing that's really profound that's happening is that it's not that, that people are changing their minds on the issue, in among every age group and really among every, demographic. And that's what's, so powerful. And the reason that's happening is because people are seeing same-sex couples marrying, and they're seeing the integrity of their relationships, and they're seeing that gay couples want to marry for the same reasons that anyone else does, and their families are, you know, the same, you know, same same complexities, same you know, same same joys and happinesses, and as people see that, they really are like, you know, of course this is right. So, so yeah, there's no question that the demographics helps us a lot. It's, I think it's because, you know, people from a much earlier, you know, kids, young kids, saw, you know, have just been exposed to openly LGBT folks in their lives. And, it just, you know, for so many young people, it's just not an issue at all. But seeing the, you know, seeing the evolution even among people who are older is great. You know, I was one of the earlier stops on my on this tour. I was in Minneapolis and I was about to go on NPR, and I was sitting in the sort of the waiting room, and this the guy, when he, this guy who was there to talk about something else, told me that his daughter had had a very close friend who came out to her in fifth grade, and but before the friend came out, he asked his daughter how did your parents vote on the constitutional amendments, to see, you know, to gauge the safety even in fifth grade. And so that story just made me, it made me so happy to hear that. To hear that the work that we're doing has those kinds of impacts, and then just to see that you know, kids are coming out in fifth grade now, and to be able to be comfortable with who you are, and not have to be, you know, not have to go through the sort of agony, is just a great great thing. So.
George, I think I saw a question from you. So can I go to George next? Are you able to get up here? Oh, good.
I think the change in message is far more important, perhaps, than people realize. As an old goat, I remember the laundry list of benefits and rights we wanted, and it was not at all appealing even to many of us in the movement. I watched Elizabeth Birch on George Stephanopoulos interview in a half hour. She never once said she loved her partner. She's looking at America with a camera in her face, and she never once said, I love this woman, I want to spend my life with her. Because we were so hung up on rights and benefits, and that message was totally incorrect, didn't persuade anybody, because our own experience tells us everybody we've known got married for love and lust, and we have exactly the same motive. So I was delighted years ago when Freedom to Marry began shifting the message deliberately, saying, let's talk love, companionship, families, the same things The same reason everybody gets married to forget fishing licenses and tax rebates and saving money on your insurance. You know the list, 120 things. In love, it was really almost sarcastically absurd, like the fishing license. And so, you know, I really commend Freedom to Marry for taking leadership in changing that message, which I think is what largely yielded success in the electoral campaign.
Thanks. I mean, it was my colleague that some of you have probably ran across, Thalia Zapatos, who was our sort of lead on the Washington campaign, who really, you know, she lives in Portland, Oregon, and she remember, you know, she would talk about the ballot campaign that our side lost in Oregon, where, and she was, you know, one of the leaders in that effort, and people, you know, were going door to door talking about benefits, and she said it was during a season of ER back in the old days, and you know, there was a lesbian doctor on the show who whose partner passed away, and there was a big custody fight, and she's like, that's what people were talking about at the door was you know, forget the fishing license, what about what do you think should happen to this, you know, isn't it terrible that this this person's parents are trying to, you know, when they had such a loving relationship, and so, you know, that led her to say, you know, we can do all of the great field work that we want, but if we're not talking about what's at the root of marriage, we're not going to persuade people that they should let us marry. And, you know, and that really is what we've had to do, is persuade people that, you know what, this is what we want.
Marriage campaign, you'll know this, George, but Thalia would often say that, you know, we're not trying to redefine marriage, but rather we just want to join it. And so that's a simple sentiment when you think about that in reflection, but powerful at the time. Steve.
Well, you mentioned Portland, so I just want to say, when you share stories, it's so powerful. I was married to my husband in Portland, Oregon. A lot of people forgot about that moment in time. We actually had a wedding. Our families came from the East Coast in California. We spent a lot of money. And then shortly thereafter, we were annulled, and they sent our check back. And what I learned on the Washington United for Marriage campaign is the value of telling your stories. And so I had a fundraiser. Spaghetti and Dinner fundraiser, and I actually told my story, and not only straight people came up to me afterwards and were giving me checks and cash, a lot of the younger gay community wasn't even aware that that happened, and they were horrified that two people had to go through that. So just to kind of connect into Portland. So the storytelling was amazing during the campaign, and I worked at Capitol Hill, and the stories that I heard were so wonderful. I should write a book. But anyway, but my question to you, I would love to hear what you think. Employment Non-Discrimination Act, ENDA, was really big for a while, and it's kind of all been kind of quieted down because we're really focusing on marriage. However, it disturbs me that in a lot of these states, you can be married, but you can be fired for being married and being gay. So I'm wondering what your thought is as... hopefully it is inevitable once we get marriage equality. What do you see happening with ENDA and also adoption rights and all the other rights that were denied?
Yeah, so ENDA is the Employment Non-Discrimination Act that's been sort of percolating on Capitol Hill for a long time. And, you know, it's what most people don't know, and truly most people don't know this, is that in many, many states in the country, you can be fired because you're gay, lesbian, or transgender. You can be, you know, you can be denied housing. You can be kicked out of public accommodations. And so, yeah, we need to get that done. And we need an all out effort to really drive that home. And I know that it's long past time. I think we all, you know, believe it's long past time. And, you know, we need to get it done, you know, in some key states while the work is happening on Capitol Hill. It's so hard to get anything done in Washington, D.C. right now. I know there are some states that are like Michigan and Pennsylvania and some states where there are campaigns that HRC and others are really driving hard to make happen. That's the big, in addition to marriage, that's the big missing link, the big piece that we still need to get done is freedom from discrimination. What happens is I think, there aren't as many instances where people are simply fired. You know, you come in and you're get married and they say, oh, you're gay, you're fired, goodbye. It's more pernicious than that when people are afraid to come out in their workplace and it happens. It's not sort of at the high level jobs. It's at it's at lower level jobs when people are just really feel like they need to be closeted. They need to hide, and it's really terrible. So.
Offer. I just want to know where Steve went. There went high. I think this is Mark. When you were talking a little bit about the work's not done, this is the and. I would offer that certainly marriage has been at the cornerstone of our movement because Mark, you made a quote in your book that says I'm going to get it wrong, so I'm going to ask you to correct me. But it speaks to that. Not everyone wants to get married, but it speaks to our humanity and our freedom as people. It's a denotation, but it's certainly not everything that our movement needs. And so keep telling your story. I think we have time for at least one more question. Oh, good.
Hi. Mark, I wonder if you could talk about something that you mentioned at the beginning of your talk, which was that there were lessons learned that can be exported to other movements, either LGBT movements or just social justice in general. Do you have like a top tips for movement learned within marriage equality?
Sure. So that's something that I'm certainly, super passionate about. And it's one of the things that did inspire me to, write the book. I want to say that, with some level of humility, you can't, we don't have the answers to everything. And you certainly can't take the what we did on marriage and sort of superimpose it on guns or the environment or climate change, etc. That having been said, I think there, if I were to rattle off a few things that I think we did learn, one of the things we talked about tonight is the importance of an emotionally resonant message. You need to be able to talk about a cause in a way that grabs people and that resonates with people emotionally, and so that they feel that in order to fulfill their own destiny of being the kind of people they want to be, that they need to be with your cause. And that takes real hard work to figure out exactly how to do that. It's both the message and the messenger. You need to figure out who the right people are to convey those points to convey that message. I think having a clear goal of what you're fighting for. I mean, with marriage, it's pretty simple and straightforward that we're fighting for marriage nationwide for same-sex couples. And it's also something that it's big. It's a big thing, and it's something that is big enough that it gets people off their couches and gets people to experience discomfort, sort of emotional discomfort and get out and have difficult conversations when it's much safer to not do that. So you need a big vision, and then you need to be able to put points on the board. You need to figure out where you can, wins beget wins. And you need to, I was actually just talking about this yesterday with Zach Silk, who ran the Washington United campaign. We were talking about the fight that he just ran, the fight on background checks here in Washington State, and the importance of changing the narrative on guns to the idea to have people understand that we can actually win something start taking away this sense of invincibility that the NRA has. So I think that's something that we've been able to do. But it takes being very strategic, looking extremely carefully at, you know, where you can win, and you know, which in which states can we, you know, can we win on, you know, on. We did that very carefully on marriage. You know, how many votes do we have? How many votes do we need in order to win either at the ballot or in the legislature? Just evaluate it very carefully and check it, double check it, triple check it, and then bring in great talent to run these campaigns. Find the resources to run them to scale. The other piece that we've done a good job of in the marriage movement is electoral work. It's making sure that your friends who vote with you get reelected, and really focusing on that. And if you really want to be, if you really want to show your muscle, knock out some people who vote against you. And nothing gets the attention of a legislature more than taking away one of their buddies' jobs. I think those are, you know, a few of the lessons. And I guess big picture, it's sticking with something for, it's having a big vision and sticking with it for a long time. I mean, this work in so many ways is, you know, the work of changing our society is a real slog in a lot of respects. And it takes, like, you know, I think about Evan Wolfson, who, you know, who I work for now and who's been at this for more than 30 years. You know, he wrote his law school thesis on why gay people should be able to marry at Harvard Law School in 1983. And he had it was very difficult for him to find an advisor. Nobody thought, you know, people thought it was ridiculous. And he stuck with it, through the years, and same with Mary Bonato, who stuck with it, and it's accepting lots of losses, and that, you know, before you get some wins. So, it's that sort of combination. I think the people who I view as the greatest leaders on our, you know, on this cause are the ones, you know, it's the Evans, it's the Mary Bonatos, it's the Tim Gills, the people who have just stuck with it, you know, year after year, decade after decade, just fighting, you know, in Tim Gills' case, investing, you know, he's now invested on LGBT equality more than $300 million. And it's that sort of persistence, even as we lose, you know, seeing that we're getting closer and closer, and then seeing us put some wins on the board. And so I guess that's, I could talk about this stuff forever, but I do think that there are things that we can share with our, you know, with other causes that are, you know, there's just so much work that needs to be done. There's so many things that are stuck right now, and we've been able to actually get some things done.
One of the things here in Washington State, just to see a few of our coalition partners in the room, is, you know, I think we have learned from one another, and that's the power of these coalitions coming together to partner together, because we do learn. You know, Washington United really wasn't one organization. It was a group of about 11 leading organizations and then another 180 partnering organizations, and that's really in partnership with you who won. So I just want to thank you, Mark, for coming out here tonight and sharing the book and really, your passion and how you've left a legacy of work in the last 13 years. I know we're going to have a few minutes to spend some time and you're going to sign some books, but just on behalf of all Washingtonians, thank you what you did to help us secure marriage in Washington State.
Thanks for mousing your way over to this podcast of Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you appreciate the series, please give us a good review. It helps more people find us. Mark Solomon is the author of Winning Marriage. In it, he tells the story of how a seemingly far-fetched goal to win the freedom to marry for all Americans came near reality in such a short period of time. Mark Solomon spoke about the fight for marriage equality at Town Hall Seattle on December 1st, 2014. And speaking of Town Hall, did you know that that venerable institution now offers a hearing loop? It's a system that allows most hearing aids to get a direct audio feed of their lectures and concerts. They're the first cultural venue in King County to install it. If you use a hearing aid, you may enjoy attending one of their talks in person soon. This talk was presented by Town Hall and University Bookstore as part of the Civics series. Series sponsors include Boeing, the Real Networks Foundation, and the True Brown Foundation. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for this recording. And thanks for tuning in to Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.